You're listening to your community radio station, KKCR Hanalei, KAQA Kilauea, K284 AL Haleiwa. It's time for In the Garden on the Farm.
Aloha, and welcome to In the Garden on the Farm, your weekly radio program that cultivates the passion and knowledge to grow well with plants and animals. We're your hosts, Robin and Paul, and on today's show, we will greet the sunrise with fresh-picked grapefruit, size up the plant subfamily Alioidiae, and grab both handles of the garden broadfork. But first, we'd like to let you know that this KKCR program is made possible by listeners like you, in partnership with Harvest Market Natural Foods and Cafe, Kauai Marine and Mower, 808 Equipment Rental, and Aya's Garden.
Aloha, Robin.
Aloha, Paul.
How you doing?
Excellent.
February. Oh, my goodness. Can you believe it? It's happening already.
The sky just keeps rearranging, doesn't it?
It does, and the sun is returning, and there's a lot of good growing happening out there. Thank goodness for the moon and the stars, which are playing a role in our gardens. And so we're going to jump into the celestial session to see what sort of celestial influences we can take advantage of and maybe ones that we would choose to avoid at this time of the month. So we're going to jump into the Hawaiian moon. And in fact, Ole Kukahi is the moon phase for today. And that is one of those avoidance moons. She rose on Kauai at 11:29 this morning, and she reaches her transit, or highest point in the sky, at 6:04 p.m. this evening, and she'll set at 12:41 a.m. on Thursday morning. 41% of the moon's beautiful face is illuminated, and the first quarter moon is coming up tomorrow at 9:22 a.m. The mana'o, or wisdom there for Ole Kukahi, it's the first of three moons in the first anahulu, or week, in the moon cycle that are not recommended for planting. Ole means nothing or without. And the anahulu, interestingly, we learned from that video that we talked about a week ago, was really the Hawaiian week was a 10-day period, one-third of the moon's transit. I hesitate to say monthly because that's tied to the Gregorian calendar, but the Hawaiian month, all based on the moon. And right now we're in the Ho'onui, or rising phase of the moon. And planting recommendations for today, again, not recommended. However, it's a good time for preparations in the garden, and Native Planters of Old Hawaii speak specifically to weeding. I know that the almanacs, the Western almanacs, recommend weeding on the waning crescent, or the waning part of the moon, but the Hawaiian wisdom is at this time. So I'm going to guess that our gardeners and farmers out there probably have some weeds that they could address. So this is the time. Get at it, folks.
Absolutely. Well, in the biodynamic look at things, today and tomorrow the moon will be in Aries, a fire sign, making it a good time to work with our fruiting plants. Maybe consider some pruning at this time. Friday through Sunday, the moon will be in Taurus, an earth sign, making it a good time to work with our root plants. And Monday, Tuesday next, the moon will be in Gemini, an air sign, making it a great time to work with our flowering plants.
And we got some of those.
Yes, we
do. You mentioned the pruning, and to be mindful, I was looking up some pruning information, and the recommendation was a calm day and a day that's not super humid. You can imagine that if you're wounding the plant by pruning and you've got super humid conditions, more likely for a fungal infection to occur. And if the wind is blasting, it could dry the plant out before that those prunes heal up. So look at your local weather conditions and make a choice based on a nice calm day if you're going to do that pruning, is what I've learned.
Always. And be sure and sharpen your pruning tools as well.
Indeed. So we're going to go to some notable news. There's some interesting things we'd love to share with you in the sustainable agriculture world. And, of course, sustainable agriculture is touched by other forms of agriculture. And we're trying to tip the scales in the direction of sustainable agriculture, but one of the developments in industrial agriculture that we're being mindful of is news that Syngenta is risking fresh China corn dispute with an unapproved trait. This story from Reuters. Syngenta AG, the Swiss company, is pressing ahead with U.S. sales of a new corn trait that is not approved in China, fueling concerns of another jarring GMO trade quarrel with the world's fastest-growing food importer, the country of China. The new product is engineered to combat pests called rootworms, which are a major problem for farmers that avoid crop rotation to make higher profits. It's a more and more common technique or practice, I should say, of farmers to do what's called corn after corn. And they're not doing the rotations that would naturally allow for pests that are very specific to a crop to reduce in number in a field before the next season. And that's why more insecticides, pesticides, and GMO crops are being utilized. But the problem here is that Chinese regulations, it takes them a couple of years to actually approve a new traded genetically engineered organism or crop, and they're coming onto the market faster in the U.S. than they can be approved. The situation is the same in the European Union. So basically farmers are risking, or it's being risked, that they won't be able to sell their crop to the consumers ultimately. And even a farmer that chooses to grow this genetically engineered corn could risk his neighbor, because if they're put in the same silo together, then the whole thing could be deemed not suitable for export as well.
Yeah, just the way that genetically modified corn seems to find its way into every food label, every food product around, too. You have to wonder how much corn is really good for us.
That's true.
We can rotate to something like squash.
And it's surprising that corn is being imported into China, obviously a rice culture, and yet the westernization of the world and of China is meaning more and more people are eating processed foods and other things that corn is a foundation of. So, interesting state of the world that we're in that way. Our next story, on the more hopeful side, Cherokee Seed Project sows respect for the past, hope for the future. This story from CNN. The Cherokee Indians are preserving the roots of their heritage with a program that allows officially recognized members of the tribe to access seeds that are unique to the Cherokee Nation. Seeds available through the Cherokee Heirloom Seed Project possess unique traits that have long made them valuable to the Cherokee Nation, including drought resistance. And again, they're only available to members of the Cherokee Nation who have a certificate of degree of Indian blood. So certainly these varieties are getting out to the wider community, but great to see an indigenous group that is taking care of their own first with something that's so precious as the plant resources that they've developed over thousands of years.
Absolutely.
And one more notable news we'd love to share with you. We're excited to announce that the next Kauai Community Seed and Plant Exchange has been set for April 19th. It's going to be at Waipa.
Ooh.
And it's happening in conjunction with the Earth Day Rising event, which is a collaboration of Malama Kauai and Waipa. It's at noon to 5. It is a Saturday, so our farmers, we're going to plead. We'll make some alternative arrangements or maybe sell out quickly at the farmer's market so you can jog on over to join us. This is the day before Easter, but it is in conjunction with the Earth Day Rising event, which is happening all weekend. They're for folks who aren't going to be bringing their produce to market on a Saturday morning or waiting in line to get them. There are opportunities to volunteer service at Waipa that Saturday morning. Maybe it'll be clearing an awai or doing other kinds of work in the Ahupua'a of Waipa, and then in the afternoon, Seed Exchange. And at the same time, there'll be live music happening over at the beach as part of the Earth Day Rising event. So really excited for that collaboration.
Yeah, excellent. Sounds like it's going to be a really festive seed exchange this year.
For sure. And I know the Waipa folks are going to be bringing seeds, and they tend tarot varieties, and it's going to be a very rich, diverse group. We're really excited for it.
Ooh la la.
You're listening to In the Garden on the Farm. This is Paul. That's Robin, and we are going to jump into a juicy topic right now.
Indeed. If you've been checking out the farmers markets lately, you'll notice there are lots of grapefruits available at the market. It is their season. Most of the common varieties we're going to see here on our market tables are pomelos, the flame grapefruit, of course, the ruby red. Oro Blanco is a beautiful light-fleshed variety. Then there's, of course, the Tahitian Pamplemousse, or green-fleshed, which is a little bit more like a pomelo.
Oh, yeah.
You want to look for shiny, heavy fruits with a good smell to them. They have a small blemish on the outside of the fruit. The rind is so thick, usually it's not going to be affecting the fruit inside, so I wouldn't worry too much about that. They're high in beta-carotene and lycopene, vitamin A, vitamin C, and the flavonoids that are actually in the pithy skin around the outside are quite good for us. So it doesn't hurt to eat a little bit of that white pith that comes off when you peel them.
Yeah. And then if I have grapefruit, it's already picked, it's on my counter perhaps. Is it going to continue to ripen, get sweeter? If I stick it in the fridge, will it stop the ripening process? What's going on there?
Most likely. I don't know that they'll continue to ripen. They will get softer and perhaps build up in sweetness. I like to keep them in the refrigerator because we pick a whole bunch at once, and I don't want them to go bad sitting on the countertop for too long. And then when I decide to eat them, I have a nice ice-cold grapefruit, which is really a treat.
Yeah. It was a tradition in my family, and we had the grapefruit knife. Are you familiar with that?
Of
with
course.
The curved blade, and of course the sugar got poured on top of them. So I think we were missing the sweetness of grapefruit you can have right here in Hawaii.
Indeed. Those ruby reds are just, they're almost like bubble gum. They are so good. Really delicious.
And you're growing them too, aren't you?
Yes, we do have some. And a lot of yards, a lot of neighborhoods have grapefruits. They tend to be really great producers. So often they kind of act like currency in the neighborhood. People share them, like bananas and avocados around here.
I know you're also a real fan of taking advantage of a huge season and harvest and preserving your foods, freezing them. Is that something you do with grapefruit as well?
Indeed, I've juiced and froze some ice cubes in the past. And then if you've got the time, candied grapefruit is quite nice, although it's a process. You can find recipes for that online at Epicurious.
Yeah. All right. Sounds good. Everybody get out there to the farmer's market and support your local farmers and take home some liquid sunshine. Right now, we are really happy to welcome our dear friend, Lisa Fuller, back into the studio. Lisa joins us again from One Song Farm in Kalihiwai, where along with her partner, son Hadley, and a dedicated team of helpers, they are producing beautiful, nutrient-dense foods that tantalize the senses and nourish the body and spirit. Their vegetable offerings are quickly snapped up by eager devotees at the Kilauea Farmers Market each Saturday. Lisa is an artful technician of the market garden and occasionally teaches classes to island residents when they're fortunate enough to do so. And all of us are here as your students as well. So great to have you back, Lisa.
It's good to be here.
Happy New Year.
Well, Happy New Year to you as well. It is a good one. It's going to continue to be a great one. Mm-hmm. Year of the Horse. Very happy about that.
What does that mean to you?
It's for me, I'm a sheep person, and so me and the horse, we're friends, and so it tends to be a supportive year for my kind.
Yeah.
And I'm ready for some softness, yes, and some fortitude forward, because it We've been doing a lot of building at the farm because, you know, it's a new, fairly new space.
Yes.
And so for us, I'm ready. The garden is really taking off. We've expanded to the point that it feels like I can actually bring a nice amount of produce to the farmer's market. Feels really good. People are happy. I've got enough kale beyond 9:30 when the market starts at 9.
Yeah.
So it's been great. Fantastic. Beautiful season.
And this is your second winter up in Kalihiwa, is that right?
Were you
there in January of last year?
We were just building up the garden mm-hmm. at that time. And so we started putting seeds in about the end of October, November, and then planting. But I wouldn't, it is a winter season, but I felt so new to the space. We really didn't know much, and there wasn't much that we had going at that time.
Right. And how has it been with the rains? I mean, again, you've moved from Moloa'a to Kalihiwai with your farm. Tremendous difference in rain, 100 inches of rain a year where you are now. And that, of course, we know that's a big challenge with vegetables that aren't really used to that kind of climate. So how has it been?
Actually, it hasn't been so bad. The part that has really been an issue is the wind, because our field is so open still at this moment that when those winds came through, we've had two major windstorms this season already. And so what I've done, what I'm seeing is that I'm still mulching the beds because it adds support to the plants for that windy season. And then because I had two beds that I left open just most recently, I didn't mulch them just to check to see if I could stop mulching the field for the winter.
Yes.
And probably I lost almost half of my plants to the wind.
But the mulch doesn't keep the soil too moist, trap
so
that
far,
moisture in?
So far not, but I am watching that. Mm-hmm. Most of the plants that I'm planting right now really don't mind some moisture, but I'm also not watering at all.
Right.
Sure, I'd venture to say that those strong winds are desiccating that water right out of the plants.
Mm-hmm. That I would agree.
Utilizing extra water because of the wind.
Yeah, I would agree.
That wind really has been brutal.
Yes. Yeah. And, of course, deep cultivation of the soil leading to good drainage, which is something that we're going to cover on the show a little bit later.
It's really the major piece that makes it possible mm-hmm. to do what we're doing and in the way that we're doing it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right on. Well, we're really excited to have you in for our discussion of all our relations. And per Robin's suggestion, we have chosen the onion family is where we started out. And then we discovered a bit more than we thought we knew, as we always do. But we've discovered that the family Aliaceae has changed according to the taxonomists in lofty ivory towers who make these decisions based on a lot of research they're doing, which reveal the relatedness of plants.
Including genetic sequencing is part of that to figure out which plants. So what used to be the Aliaceae has now divided out, and the main crops that we want to talk about in all our relations right now are now in the Aliaceae. But as you know, I always like to go outward first and into the plant order where the family that we're going to talk about lives. And the relations in that order, which is the Asparagales order. So very interestingly, the asparagus, of course, family is included there. Agave, hyacinth, lily of the valley, people from the mainland USA know this beautiful forest flower. Amaryllis, a bulbing plant that does really well here. And very surprisingly to me, also aloe. The aloe family being closely related to the onion family, which mm-hmm. I found incredibly interesting. Although when I do cut into some bunching onions that I've been growing, this beautiful sort of ooze of clear gelatin, even very similar to what I find in aloe vera, sometimes comes out there, and I find that to feel really good to be eating. I know the slippery things are extremely good for our bodies.
Yes. And, of course, they're all part of the monocot division. And monocots we've spoken about before on the show a little bit, but we wanted to sort of touch back in and talk about some of the things that distinguish the monocots from the dicots, and what does that mean? So monocots represent a quarter of all the flowering plants. They have flower parts in fours or fives, or multiples of fours or fives. And unlike the dicots, they have parallel venation in the leaves. They generally don't have a petiole, or the leaf stem. The blade base has a sheathing around the stem of the plant. They tend to be mostly herbs. They have it seems like one of the most important differences is that they have vascular bundles scattered in the stem, unlike a dicot, which has the cambium layer, that thin layer of tissue that moves water and nutrients up and down the plant. And this allows for them to be much hardier and much less likely for an insect attack or other damage to be lethal to the plant stem. And that's why coconut trees can be climbed, although it's not thought to be the best management practice, but we certainly see coconut trees on the island with all those pock marks in them, and that's from years and years of people going up to trim the coconut trees, and they use spikes to climb the trees. That would certainly kill or gravely wound a dicot plant, but a monocot plant, because the vascular tissue is in these little bundles all the way in the middle of the stem, it doesn't risk that most vital part of the transmission of fluids and nutrients in the plant as well. And as well, they have one seed leaf as opposed to two seed leaves, the cotyledons. And examples would be corn, onions, of course, that we're going to talk about today, rice, taro, banana, turmeric, which we covered last month. So many of the economically important plants, the grasses, and the things that feed humanity are monocots. And one of the questions was why monocots developed. And there's a thought that what I had heard was monocots are a later evolutionary stage than the dicots. And yet in doing some more research, it seems like that's either true or not true. What we do know is that the modern monocots and dicots both evolved from ancient forms. So it may have been that the ancient form of a dicot actually spawned a monocot, or it may be the other way around. And at any rate, the reason it happened must have been, if we believe in evolution, and the fact that species radiate out and speciate or become different from their ancestral form, they do so because they're filling a niche in the environment that wasn't filled before. And so they had some sort of competitive advantage to that. So if monocots truly did come from dicots, and that one seed leaf came from fusing two seed leaves into one, there must have been some competitive advantage there. We certainly know that grasses were so good at competing because wind dispersed, didn't need an animal to disperse them into hostile, harsh, dry environments that maybe had not been colonized by the kind of animal associations or insect associations that require for plants to pioneer a new location. So it's up to the further investigations of scientists to reveal more and more. But for now, we know we're grateful to have the monocots, and they represent a lot of food plants, and certainly the onion family, subfamily of Alioidea, is an important one for all of us on this planet. For anyone who walks into a kitchen, all you need to do really is throw some onions on a griddle, and somebody will come in and go, "Wow, that smells fantastic. What are you cooking?" And there's nothing but onions and oil in the pan. So we got to give it up to the onions for sure.
Absolutely.
Sun always says that you could grill up some onions and garlic and put it on top of cardboard and he would eat it. It's just anything yep. With those two on it.
They are that good.
Sure, and so many kinds of onions, but also related to onions proper are shallots, garlic, leeks, chives, and then a whole entire huge amount of bunching onions, which are so popular and do so well in Kauai gardens. And I've noticed that everybody sort of has their pet varieties that they particularly like. And I know for myself, the Tokyo long white bunching has been incredible. But Paul, you turned me on to red beard, which I thought was really just a fabulous bunching onion as well.
It is a beautiful one, and you saw it get red.
It did not get red in my garden, just a tiniest bit down at the base.
I think it both happens with age and also with cold. So it may be that it's not representing as much. This a seed from Kitazawa Seed Company, and they, you've got the catalog right out there right now.
Of course, their selections are
super
wonderful.
Super yummy one, and onions are great because they're, and we'll get more into this, but they really are one of those bomb-proof plants that, as Sun says, plant onions and you'll feel like you have some skills as a gardener because they're not bothered. They have all those volatile oils that repel insects. In fact, garlic is recommended as a companion plant to keep insects away and even prevent fungal infections from happening with their companions as well. So,
also the root knot nematode. It is not affected by the root knot nematode.
Nice.
And it'll give a better rest. So that's when we plant the bunching onions or the shallots. If there's a bed that's been highly affected by the root knot nematode or we've been seeing the signs of it on our roots, then we'll give it an onion or shallot shot, depending on the time of year. The bunching onions we find we can grow year-round. The bunching onions are excellent because in a sustainable garden, they are sustainable because all you have to do is take one of those onions. We always pick the largest out of our bunches, pick the largest ones, and then put those right back in the ground, and they divide again. And that's year-round. What I have found with the shallots, though, is that they are affected by day length. The shallots that we have right now, I probably won't be planting them because what I'm finding is they're going to seed fast as days are lengthening. So then come June 21st, after the solstice, I will start planting my shallots again because they hold. Because I don't want them to go to flower because it pulls all of that energy out of the root, which is what I'm, or the bulb, which is what I want. I want all the juju there. So I'm always, if I do find the flowering happening on my shallots, I'll just clip the flowers and use them in salads or in my cooking, but clip those flowers if you want your roots to continue to grow, and that's what we've been doing.
Yeah.
Well, that's beautiful. None of my shallots have even attempted flowering yet. I've been watching very closely for that, no matter what time of year I've planted them.
So it could be a different day length specific variety.
Exactly.
And that's Glenn Tevis's shallot?
It is. Again? It's from Molokai.
Yeah. Awesome. This is In the Garden on the Farm on KKCR, Kauai Community Radio, with Paul and Robin, and we're here in studio with Lisa Fuller of One Song Farm, and we're talking about the delicious subfamily Alioidiae, which belongs to onions and all of their kin, garlic and such, and I'm hopeful that we can talk some more varieties, because here in this time of year, it may not be too late to plant your onion starts, and certainly all the catalogs are out now, and the selection is going to be the greatest right now for people to be able to see what they want. So,
sure. Well, before we get into the full-size onion, which is, of course, kind of the holy grail of onions, I've had extremely good luck with leeks in my garden. They grow really well. They hold also in the ground for a long time. Over a year later, I can still be harvesting beautiful, perfect leeks. Mm-hmm. And the two varieties of those that I've grown really well are King Richard and Blue des Soleils, which references this very nice blue-green color that the foliage gets. You know that onions almost get that powdery, not a powdery mildew, but a soft kind of coating on them that makes them look a little bit blue, and that's just a fabulous thing to have leeks any time of year.
Say that variety name again.
Bleu de Soleil.
Love it. And they will go to seed here as well, in time.
In time, yeah. It took longer than a year because I just couldn't wait anymore. I had to harvest that last one and hadn't done any seeds yet.
Now, if they go to seed, are they viable seeds? Is good the question. Because my onions will go to seed, my shallots will go to seed, but they're punk. The seeds are punk. They're not usable.
Oh.
And so in my experience at this moment, it's not a sustainable crop to be able to get my own seed back. Right. Though a very bizarre plant called a sea onion, it may be in, it has to be in this family. It has that look to it. We'd got a plant, and of course I'm not going to know where it was from. Sun would know. But it went to seed, and the seeds are viable.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
But the plant itself has no flavor, so it's not going to help us in our sustainable garden. But that's the only one that I know of at this time that has actually gone to seed, and Sun wanted me to tell you, Robin, that if any onion is going to go to seed, it would be you who would be propagating it because of your deep love for the plants. And so any plant would probably perform for you. And you're in a good spot as well, being in the Mauloa area.
It's true. It's true. And then in the chive world, there are multiple different kinds of chives that people grow. We talk about garlic chives, onion chives, which look very much like miniature bunching onions, extremely small with hollow stems, versus the garlic chive, which has more of a flat grass-like leaf. And then there's flowering leeks, which is something I also picked up from Kitazawa. It looked so interesting, and I've been loving them. They're tiny leeks. They do flower and seed quite readily, but instead of having the garlic flavor, they do have a flat leaf like a garlic chive, but it's very oniony, leek-ish. And they're really quite nice, beautiful white flowers. Love that one.
I can imagine presenting them whole in a particular dish would be very ornamental and beautiful.
Sure. I think classically the way they're served in Chinese cuisine is flower buds. So the little capsule before the flowers even pop out of it are harvested and used in cooking. They really are quite beautiful.
Yeah. I hope everybody's enjoying their lunch right now because I'm getting ready for it with this discussion.
No doubt. Well, into bulbing onions, because they have to be some of the most striking plants that we feel so great about when we go out and harvest a basket of those. You feel like you really made some food. You know, you grew some food, and they're just so beautiful to watch grow and so easy to grow as well. We'll talk more about good growing next week. But two of my favorite varieties that I've found here are the Super X or the Granix. And these are short day varieties that are considered the Maui onion if grown in Maui, but can be grown anywhere in the subtropics here with really great success.
I want to reiterate about the short day. It's mandatory that you choose a short day variety. The long days are meant for those places closer to the poles, not us. And your onions will be deeply affected by our short days if you choose a longer variety. So just don't do it. One of the ones that we trialed last year that was fantastic was the Pumbaa variety. And this year we're trialing White Castle.
That must be a pure white onion.
I think so. Mm. And I don't have any notes on that one yet. It's new to us. We also did the Candy last year. And I experienced a splitting in the Candy where it wasn't just the single bulb. They had two bulbs, which made it, they didn't last very long outside of the ground. The other thing is, that's something to be aware of, is that there are many, many of the onions that are going to grow here that aren't really good at storing. But that Pumbaa did pretty well. It did excellent, actually. I would say 95% of what I, probably even more than that, a little bit more, did fine as far as storage. But they do have some parts of it that will rot. But with the candy, another thing I found out is that if you keep your soil too dry, your onions will split. Mm. And so they want moderate water, mm-hmm. that your onions do.
Moderate, yet not too much, because they are also very sensitive to too much water. And I think ground watering beats out overhead watering, particularly in an onion crop, because if you're watering from the top with sprinklers, the water will be falling in between all of those sheaths day after day as you're irrigating, and ultimately that can just deteriorate the onion faster.
I would agree.
I would imagine that varieties are, the development of varieties, ongoing development is important commercially, given the fact that onions are shipped across the planet, and for that storage quality, that's probably something that is developed year upon year, and that new varieties are coming out to replace the old ones, just if for no other reason, to be on top of the market, you know? So
sure, storage. And in general, I think short-day onions don't store as well as higher latitude or longer day onions. So we're not really growing ones that are particularly great for storage here. Although I noticed in the Johnny's catalog this year, he does have a new red short day onion called Red Coach. That's definitely on my shopping list for this year.
Yeah.
Something also to be aware that the sweet onions definitely don't store well. And so things like the Granix are going to store better. The Pumba is going to store better. Those that are considered yellow are going to store better. Uh-huh. Your sweet onions, and you know it's a sweet onion if the skins are thicker. So if your circles are wider when you cut your onion, uh-huh. if they're tighter, it's going to be a better storage onion. It's not a sweet onion. Uh-huh. So if it has wider...
And you're saying the Maui, the Granix, is which kind?
The Maui for sure is a sweet. The Granix is not. That's a yellow onion.
Oh, okay.
The Granix is a yellow.
Yeah, when I'm in the market and I'm seeing the Maui onions, I often avoid them just because I'm looking for that really firm onion, and I'm always concerned that there's going to be we find soft spots on our onions when we're in the market. When I see those Maui onions, they're just not as firm. And so maybe I have to retrain myself. It's a different animal, mm-hmm. and I need to go for it and not think that it's soft and mealy or something, is what I would think if it was just a non-sweet variety, I suppose.
It's definitely going to bring a different texture and flavor to whatever you're doing with it. And the sweet ones are excellent for anything raw. Mm. So putting them in salads or that kind of thing, or putting them in your kimchi or something like that. Adds another level of flavor and sweetness, mm-hmm. for sure. Actually, and just to say this, all you farmers out there, would-be farmers, this is an excellent area of possibility for focus, because right now there isn't a lot of onion producers out there. In fact, we produce onions for ourselves, and that's it. I do bring shallots to market, but that's very rare, and it's a hot treat. But as far as onions themselves, I agree with you. When I harvested my first onions, I felt like I could do anything. I had those onions in my kitchen. There were no trips to the store to get something that was so basic.
Right.
It felt great. So I invite anyone to just give it a try. And right now is the time to get them going.
It really is. And we discuss the day length thing, which we'll talk a little bit more about in the next show. However, this time of year when the day length is increasing is when we're going to get the best bulbing out of our onions. So planting them right now is going to give us our harvests in about March or April or even into May, considering what the weather's like.
Mm-hmm. Typically about 100 days. From planting, or uh-huh. It depends on what we use to plant, whether it's direct seeding or whether it's the starts, the small starts, or whether it's the small onions.
Sets.
The sets, correct. Thank you.
So other kinds of varieties, or should we jump into some other species?
Sure.
So thanks to the work of the Bishop Museum, I was able to acquire some more varieties, or rather to say species, that exist within Alioidiae. And we have mentioned the leeks, but we've mentioned also on the show a couple of times that elephant garlic is the same species as leek. And we've also heard that growers on Maui have had great success growing the elephant garlic. Now that is at elevation. Not sure if they would do well in the lowlands of Kauai, but certainly worth a try. Have you guys tried it over there at Wonsong, the elephant garlic?
No.
We got to give them a shot, because those things are great. And as we know, garlic is really hard to grow here, really hard to bulb up here in the subtropics. And we're relying upon some Filipino and perhaps other varieties from Southeast Asia that have yet to come to light. But that elephant garlic, being a different species, the leek species, does predominate here in terms of its ability to produce, or so we've heard and read. We also have the Japanese pickling onion, which is rakyo or jiaotu. This is Allium chinense, native to China. It's similar to the shallot, but the odor and flavor is said to be different. It's vegetatively propagated. Now, in addition to the alliums, the only other genus that exists within Alioidiae that is said to be or recorded to be cultivated in the Hawaiian Islands is one called Tolbagia. And it's known as society garlic, and we've seen this in gardens. We had a shot of growing it a couple of years ago. Tolbagia violacea is the one that for sure is grown here. It's native to South Africa, which is one of the, and especially the Cape region, which is one of the most diverse floristic regions on the planet. Just a tremendous amount of wildflowers from that area. And it is used mostly as an ornamental, although it is edible. It has beautiful lavender flowers. Anti-cancer properties are reported. There's reportedly a variegated variety, which I've not seen, which is quite popular. Robin's nodding her head.
It's quite common here. I've seen the variegated variety in many gardens and landscapes.
Yeah. And then also records of Tolbagia fragrans and Tolbagia similari are also reported, sort of historical records with folks looking at the herbariums from maybe decades and decades ago and said, okay, it was collected once, but whether or not they still exist in the Hawaiian Islands, we don't know. But if we have access to them, we should grow the diversity and learn from some of these as well. The final one that I mentioned, that similari, is a fragrant garlic, is one of the common names. So it certainly seems like it's worth investigating from a scent as well as an edible standpoint. So next week, we're going to look at good growing of our subfamily. We will focus more on the onions. Thanks, Lisa and Robin, for delving in. And I know it's hard to sort of not go all the way there, but we want to save some gold for next week.
Sure, but you really can't stop us now.
There was one other variety I wanted to just put out there, because you have seen this out in the markets. It's called Perplet. It's a mini onion, and it's only a 60-day onion. Ooh. And so this is one that farmers will give a go and bring it to the markets. And it's lovely. It's quite lovely. It has this beautiful purple color to it. And the size is a lot easier to work with than a shallot, because what I've found is our shallots are kind of small, but wow, they're worth it. They're worth the effort. But having our own onions, but the purplet's a nice in between and easily done.
Yeah. Sounds like a good starter onion for a container, or somebody who has a small garden.
Certainly. And we actually put them in our earth boxes as well. If people want to give that a go, depending on where you live.
Can you tell us about the earth box?
Not really. It's online. There's a whole it would be a whole conversation.
All right.
But it's definitely a product worth looking at. We've had challenges doing it organic. There isn't a lot of information from the company about growing organic in the boxes. They use Miracle-Gro a lot. But
it's a miracle that stuff grows when you pour that stuff on it.
I know, it's amazing. But if anyone wants to give the Earth boxes a try, if you want to consult with Sun about his trials, you're welcome to touch base with him.
Fantastic. All right, so this is In the Garden on the Farm on Kauai Community Radio. We want to remind you to stay tuned for Kauai Vibrations with Tracy coming up at 1 o'clock. And it's time for Secrets of the Soil Builders. And today we're going to cover the garden broad fork, otherwise known as the deep fork cultivator, the U-bar. There's many names, but this is a super tool, and we know that One Song Farm uses it very well, exquisitely, and teaches folks how to use it. So take it away, Lisa. Tell us all about it.
Okay. Well, we call it the U-bar, and one of the place that we use it the most is our beds that have already been worked. So it's not a tool I would recommend to open soil. What we always recommend, obviously, is double digging as a beginning to opening soil. Double digging is a methodology that we use, our biointensive methodology. Easily, there's information online about that as well. Or you can check out any writings from John Jevons. Will give you deep information about that particular procedure. So we start off with the double digging, and what that does is it opens soil down 24 inches. And so what we're getting down to is subsoil. We're opening the subsoil, but keeping the topsoil intact, because the majority of your nutrients are happening within the first 6 inches of your soil. But what needs to happen first is we need to be adding air to the soil. And the soils on this island are traditionally heavy clay, compacted. And so opening them up is going to be quite helpful for anything that we're going to grow here. And what the U-bar, we bring the U-bar along after we've already double dug, so that I'm not double digging every time that I open a bed. It's like once or twice a year we'll do double digging to open the bed at the beginning. And then I'll just single fork a couple of times, but then my third crop I'll do the U-bar. Mm-hmm. So it's a rotation. So I'm kind of it's a mental note for myself when I put in my lettuces, and then I put in a brassica, and then I'll put in my heavy feeders, my beets or chard, and then after that I'll do the U-bar. So it's a rotation like that. Because the U-bar is going to disrupt the topsoil and the structure of the topsoil, but not as much as double digging or tilling are going to do. And therefore it's still adding air to the soil, which is necessary for the microbes that are breaking down the nutrients to become bioavailable to the plants. So adding air to the soil is absolutely necessary for the life of for the bio life in your soil. But you don't want to disrupt that life cycle too grandly as well, so that's why we double dig maybe twice a year, because we don't want to break up that structure. But the U-bar, it's an excellent tool. Our tool has two handles. There's a handle on each side. It has seven tines. The tines are about 18 inches long, 18 to 22 inches long.
Beautiful.
And those tines are round on our tool. There are other tools like Big Red that have a single handle in the center, and the tines are more flat and sharp. So there are different ways of doing it. We've chosen this particular tool, and we actually had it made on island by a gentleman named Ron Hadley, and he is in the Kilauea area, and I was given permission by him to give out his phone number. And this is Ron Hadley in Kilauea, 808-651-1916, and he can actually make a U-bar for you on island. As anything that comes to this island, shipping is outrageous, usually twice as much as the thing that you actually choose to purchase, and that would be a U-bar because of the weight of it.
Yes.
The nice thing about this tool is that the weight is distributed so that someone like me, fairly slight, but a strong farm girl, just want to add that, strong farm girl, I can carry out this tool easily to the field. I can utilize it easily. It's a tool that does excellent digging, with it, but it uses levers, and so it's meant to be a high efficiency tool with the least amount of work, and that's why I love it, because I don't have to turn on a machine to open up my soil. And that's one of the major benefits. It's definitely a sustainable tool.
And people have a lot of fun using them too, yeah?
Once you get your balance, it's just like surfing, you know? Yeah, there's a little there's a learning curve.
Uh-huh.
But once you get it down, yeah, it's people do have a good time doing it.
Closely related is that tool that folks call the Big Red, that has that single handle that you were talking about. And from observing both, I have quite a bit of experience on the Big Red and not really on the U-bar, although I've seen folks using it at your farm, is it really is a different tool. And you can actually use the Big Red, which has much larger tines, to break some fresh ground. Whereas if you tried, it just wouldn't do the job that you're using the U-bar for. The tines are wider, more widely spaced, and I don't think you get the same kind of soil conditioning that you get from the U-bar.
Yeah, but I haven't really utilized Big Red, so I it's hard for me to compare, but I agree with what you've said.
Yeah. And then when you have done the U-bar, what further shaping of the bed do you wind up doing? Do you use a digging fork following it to shape?
I certainly do. And John Jevons will also recommend using a rake to, just because you may need to move soil more than a digging fork is going to do.
Right.
So the shaping of the bed, because the U-bar does get down there. I mean, it's a good 18 inches to 22 inches. It does a good job. What you don't want to do is be picking up the soil too much, because you don't necessarily want to mix your subsoil in with your topsoil. You're wanting to open up that soil. So just you don't need to get too bam-bam with it and start tossing your soil around. This is just meant to open that up deeper than what a single forking would do.
Yeah.
And then reshaping. We like to have a nice rise in the center of our raised bed, so it has a nice kind of half circle look to it, and then a trenching on the ends to just keep our water in place.
Mm-hmm.
But that bed, I also highly recommend if you double dig, to definitely get a soil test, because it can also, U-barring often can mix up your soil a lot, and also you can get some subsoil up inside your topsoil, so it's good to be just double-checking your beds and do some periodic soil tests to make sure that your mixture is still an effective mixture. Yeah. At the top layers.
Tends to be nutrient deficient and lower pH down low, yeah? Although some leaching of nutrients may be brought up if you actually do that unintended mixing of your subsoil.
Well, sometimes it's desired, because you have too much of something that you really can't take out,
uh-huh.
And therefore it would be recommended to mix a little deeper.
Hmm.
if you have that.
Right.
But all in all, the U-bar is an excellent tool in between single forking to add more air to your soil, and then doing double digging less often than that.
Well, I did a little research, and John Jevons' book, How to Grow More Vegetables, 8th edition, actually has a beautiful design of the U-bar cultivating fork in the book that you can check out or talk to Ron about. Sounds like he's already got the design down.
He's got a design. He's got the one that we gave him because we had the tool previously and he took all the measurements from the one we brought from the mainland.
Cool.
Very cool. So we're going to jump over to announce some quick announcements. We want to let folks know that coming up this weekend is the Kauai Gathering of the Realms. Saturday and Sunday, February 8th and 9th, it's at the Teropatchanana Hola. And it's going to be a very special event where the folks who come are going to create the event. And I've already spoken with a number of people who are bringing some very special offerings, some knowledge. And that's happening, again, at the Tarot Patch. For more information, you can go to gatheringoftherealms.com. The Sustainable Agriculture Program at Kauai Community College is starting its second phase of offerings, and that is the Ag Exposure Farm Tours and Hands-on Learning Experiences starting up February 22nd. You can call 245-8318 to register or go to gofarmhawaii.org for more information. We also have the Kauai Permaculture Design Course also beginning on February 22nd in Molawa'a. And more information for that can be found at permaculturekauai.com. If you would like your event or an announcement, or if you have a question you'd like to pose to us, we invite you to send it to inthegardenonthefarm@gmail.com. Please try to send that in a couple of weeks in advance so we can make sure that it gets onto our calendar. And we want to thank you so much for tuning in today. And you are listening to KKCR Hanalei, KAQA Kilauea, K284AL Haleiwa. This has been In the Garden on the Farm with your hosts, Paul and Robin. We'd like to thank our guest on the show today, Lisa Fuller of One Song Farm. Lisa, thank you for joining us again.
My pleasure.
Honored to have you. And folks can find Lisa's treats, all these beautiful vegetables, maybe some shallots and other yummies at the Kilauea Farmers Market, which starts 9 a.m. sharp, and that's at just next to Kauai Mini Golf there in Kilauea. Would you like to give contact?
Sure. And we're in the back, by the way. Go, just be patient. Walk through the whole market to get to the gold. Okay, all the way in the back. And if you have any questions for me or Sun, our phone number is 808-635-3020. We check emails very periodically, and that's at onesongfarm@gmail.com, O-N-E-S-O-N-G, farm@gmail.com.
And we'll be hopeful for another garden sharing workshop experience coming up in the year, which are always well attended, and we learn a lot at those at One Song Farm. We want to give our special thanks to our engineer, Jack, who helps us out. And I want to give a very special happy birthday to my sister, Mary Wolf, which is today, February 5th. Please tune in again next week for more stimulating conversation on our relationship with the life of the land that gives us life. Aloha.